have a guest with me, not my son, but one of our other children. I won't mention her name. I try to avoid giving any details about my children, but I have my gorgeous, stupendous, brilliant daughter here. How you doing, daughter?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. Are you? This is your first X Spaces. You're speaking probably in front of thousands of people here. How do you feel? Are you nervous?
I'm very nervous. I'm not like you.
Well, you know, I always tell my students not to worry whenever they're about to make any, you know, presentations in class, because the number one fear that people have, even ahead of death, is public speaking. But you know what? If you practice it, you'll overcome the fear, and hopefully one day you'll surpass your dad.
It's how your heart to beat.
I love you. All right. You want to stick around or you?
I have to go study.
Okay. She has to go study, guys. She's got a big test.
Bye, guys. Enjoy.
See you later. All right. Love you more. All right. Here we go, guys. So today what I wanted to do is spend a few minutes talking about the protesters that we're seeing on campus, you know, the very sexy, the very fashionable keffiyeh, akin to the beautiful revolution of Che Guevara, akin to the beautiful and liberating Nazi swastika. It's so cool to be in a keffiyeh because it reminds me of, you know, the being stopped at the noble checkpoints in Beirut, where if you were of the wrong religion or if they didn't like you, they would put a bullet through your head. Or when my parents were kidnapped by the glorious and noble freedom fighters of Fatah, who were also wearing keffiyeh. So it's wonderful to see so many people wearing that gorgeous sartorial accoutrement. So I want to contrast some of those just degenerates, imbeciles, castrated fools, ignorant, just walking Dunning-Krugers that are populating our universities these days. And I want to actually contrast that to actual heroes. Before I discuss some of these heroes, I want to take a minute or two and explain the concept of virtue signaling, which many of you have heard of by now, but I want to contextualize it against another type of signaling. Signaling theory is something that is covered in many different disciplines. So in economics, you talk about signaling theory, and in consumer behavior, you could talk about signaling behavior, right? Conspicuous consumption is a form of signaling, right? Animals engage in various forms of signaling, right, in the mating market. So there's a concept in biology called Coste signaling. This is something, so I talk about the difference between virtue signaling and Coste signaling in the parasitic mind, which I truly hope, I beg you, I implore you, not because I'm going to make $3 off any singular purchase of a book that you will purchase, you know, of mine, but because I truly believe that since this is a battle of ideas, since we need to inoculate people against parasitic ideas, well, what better way than to administer the mind vaccine, right? To inoculate yourself against bad ideas. And if I may say so, the parasitic mind offers you that mind vaccine. So please get out there, buy 1, 2, 3, 5 copies, gift it to other people, give it to your children as they're about to head off to university. This is how we win the battle. So anyways, in the parasitic mind, I talk about the distinction between costly signaling and virtue signaling. Now, of course, virtue signaling is exactly what all of these degenerates are doing on university campuses. But what is costly signaling? So what I'm going to describe now is something that originally I had discussed in several of my early books, The Evolutionary Basis of Consumption, The Consuming Instinct, and so on, because I used it in the context of studying the evolutionary roots of consumption, of consumer behavior. But then I applied it to the current issues that we see all around us. So here we go. There are two types of processes, evolutionary processes, that lead to the evolution of particular morphological traits or behavioral patterns, right? There is natural selection, and there is sexual selection. Natural selection is the evolutionary mechanism that results in an animal having a adaptation that confers survival advantage to it. So for example, the evolution of camouflaging, right? The fact that some animals can completely, prey animals can completely blend with their environment so that they're not eaten by a predator. Well, that camouflaging evolves through the process of natural selection. Now, there are many traits that couldn't have evolved via natural selection, because if anything, they reduce your chances of surviving, in the sense that, for example, it might actually increase your chance of you, succumbing to predation. And of course, the example that I always use, just because it's so vivid, people can so relate to it, but there are millions of these examples. An example of a sexually selected trait is the peacock's tail, right? Because the peacock's tail could not have evolved to be so conspicuous, to have such iridescent colors, to have such, exaggerated size. Because if anything, those things increase the chances of a predator seeing you. It decreases your chances of you taking flight when you have such a burdensome tail. Physiologically, it's very costly to carry that tail. So it couldn't have evolved because it confers a survival advantage. And so it evolves because it confers a mating advantage, and hence sexual selection. So those are traits or behavioral patterns that evolve because they confer a mating advantage to the animal, right? And so you could imagine risk-taking in the human context, the fact that men are much more likely to engage in risk-taking behavior as a form of sexual signal, that would be a sex-specific, sexually selected trait, in this case, risky behavior, okay? Now we're going to come in a second to costly signaling. Now, for that tail, meaning the peacock's tail, for that tail to be a honest signal, right? An honest signal means what? An honest signal, honest in the sense that it truly does convey to the peahens, the females of that species, that this is a good signal, this is an honest signal of my phenotypic quality. So for a signal to be an honest one, honest in the sense that every pretender can't just fake it, then it has to be handicapping. That's called the handicap principle in evolutionary biology. And for it to be handicapping, it has to be costly. In other words, a signal is not worth its salt, if I can put it that way, if it doesn't carry a costly signal. Now, costly can mean different currency for different species. In the case of the peacock, it's saying, look, despite the fact that this tail puts me at a great predation disadvantage, the fact that I can have such an elaborate ornamentation, and yet here I am, don't you think you should mate with me? Isn't that an honest signal of my phenotypic quality? So now I hope you see, I can't believe I'm giving you all this unbelievable wisdom for free. Do the right thing and go subscribe to my content. Don't be parasites, right? What makes this beautiful is that I provide you this content at 9 p.m. when my wife is rolling her eyes, why are you going and doing this for free? And hopefully you guys, in some small measure, repay by supporting those who give you all this stuff. In any case, let's continue. So the costly signal has to be handicapping, lest everybody can imitate it. So take, for example, in the context of a rite of passage that you find, this, by the way, I discuss in several of my early books, a rite of passage that is meant to demonstrate to the ladies of a tribe, hey, choose me because I'm the real deal. I'm a warrior. Well, if all it takes for the rite of passage is for us to do 10 push-ups, well, guess what? That can't be an honest signal. That can't be a costly signal, because even the fat slobs, sorry, I didn't mean to say fat, the differently weighted slobs or the differently weighted healthy at any size slobs can also do 10 push-ups. And therefore, if everybody can do 10 push-ups and the ladies are trying to determine who is the, you know, the top specimen and, you know, who's the slob, well, they can't. So how about we come up with some rites of passage that are truly costly so that then we can differentiate the fakers and pretenders from the real deals. So now I hope you could see the framework that I'm putting together for you for real honest signaling when it comes to being a freedom fighter versus the degenerates on university campuses that know nothing and that are supporting modern day Nazis. Okay? So let's keep going. So what would be an example, by the way, of a rite of passage that is costly? Well, in the Amazon, you've got tribes that engage in a ritual. I discussed this in my 2011 book, The Consuming Instinct, where they have to be bitten repeatedly, numerous times, by a bullet ant. The bullet ant has been ranked as the animal that, if it stings you or bites you, gives you the highest pain reaction. And it's called the bullet ant. I mean, that's not its official scientific name, but its colloquial name is the bullet ant, because when it stings you, it's as painful as if you were shot. Now, so if a single bullet ant bites you, you're in trouble. You're in pain. You're going to go through pain delirium. Now imagine if I take a bunch of bullet ants, I get them drunk so that they're kind of listless, I interweave them into these gloves so that when they wake up out of their stupor, you put your hands in those gloves so that as they wake up and they're super pissed off and in a nasty mood, they're all stinging you. So it's not one bite, it's a swarm of bites on both of your hands. And as you're getting destroyed by these ants, again, remember, one bullet ant bite and you're in excruciating pain. Imagine many. You can't start screaming like a little girl. You can't start screaming like the degenerates on campus, which when they're being, you know, pushed aside by the cops, they go, ow, ow, right? No, there is none of that, right? You have to show that you can withstand the pain. Now, that ritual has to be done on 20 separate occasions, like different days. You have to go through this insane pain before a girl is willing to say, maybe I'll give you a shot. So that's what we mean by costly signaling. So now you can see how I've given you the theoretical, the evolutionary psychological and evolutionary biological framework to understand real fight for freedom that has to be costly, right? You have to put your neck on the line, literally. Otherwise, it's a bullshit signal. It's a fake signal. It's performative, right? That's exactly what it is on the campus now. I'm speaking now as a 20-year-old degenerate who knows nothing. I need to show that my life has meaning, just like my parents went and marched with Bob Dylan to fight against the Vietnam War. We have our own ideological struggles. Now, I know nothing. I don't know what from the river to the sea means. I don't know which river. I don't know which sea. I don't know what Hamas stands for. I don't know what Islam stands for. I don't know what Judaism purports. I don't know what the ancestral history of Israel is. I don't know the history of Israel since 1948. I know nothing. But I know that if I wear a keffiyeh, I'm super cool. It's like wearing a Che Guevara revolution. I'm that moron. I'm that imbecilic. I'm that much of an ideological degenerate. Free, free Palestine. Okay? That's fake. That's vacuous. That's virtue signaling. Now I'm going to come to what I promised you, which is what real freedom fighters look like, what real heroes look like. So I actually went through, I've been doing my show for 10 years now. I started in 2014. And I couldn't believe it because I was going through my list of people that I've had on the show. And, you know, I forgot some of the people. I can't believe that the content that I've amassed, which I hope that you will go and, you know, consume all of it. I think right now on my channel, I'm at Sad Truth 1676. I've done 1676 shows. Not all of them are chats. I'm going to say about one-fifth, I would say about 20% are long-form chats, which is still a lot. That's over 300 chats, okay? So I went through every single chat that I could find, and I tried to identify. Now, I've had many, many, I mean, if anything, probably the most common theme across all of my guests, other than they're all, you know, fascinating people that have, you know, really interesting things to say, is that in many cases, you know, they're courageous, they're fighting within, you know, against the current. Now, in some cases, it might be guys who fought against the COVID vaccine. It might be physicians, Jay Bhattacharya. It might be Scott Atlas, and so on. But I'm going to focus today, since we're talking about Israel-Palestine, on people who've stood up within the context of, you know, speaking against Islam, speaking about the horrors of what happens in Palestinian society, to women, to children, to religious minorities. And so I apologize from the start if I miss out on some names. I wrote down maybe 50 names, and I put stars next to some of the names that meet the criterion of they're speaking about the Middle East, about Palestine, about Israel, about Islam. So I'm going to start with my most recent guest, which took place yesterday. It's Mossab Hassan Youssef, who is just a remarkable individual. This is a guy who is the son. I mean, actually, he wrote a book in 2010, a New York Times bestseller called Son of Hamas. He is the son of one of the co-founders of Hamas. So he grew up, I mean, it'd be difficult to say that a degenerate idiot from Oberlin College who knows nothing about Palestinian society knows more about Palestinian society than the son of Hamas, right? Well, please go and watch our chat. I'm telling you, you won't regret it. It's the pinned tweet. I posted it directly on X. It's the pinned tweet there. It's also on my YouTube channel. It's also on my podcast, so you can consume it in one of several ways. By the way, on a different note, I posted I recently gave two lectures at Cornell University, my alma mater, and I posted so far the first one, which is on the parasitic mind. I posted it again everywhere, both on my YouTube channel, my podcast, and also on X. And Elon Musk, who's become a good friend, shared it. And as a result of Elon being kind enough to share it, it has gotten so far, you ready? I mean, these numbers just don't make sense. It's gotten 26 million views. I want to contextualize what that looks like. You publish an academic paper, and I love publishing scientific papers. You know, I've been a professor for 30 years, and it's part of our responsibility as professor to create knowledge, to disseminate knowledge through peer-reviewed journals. So I love that stuff. But I want to talk about the velocity at which information travels, say in academia versus in all of these new mediums. Well, if you publish a paper, first of all, it takes you 2, 3, 4 years before it gets into a journal. And then you're lucky if it's a successful paper, if after 5 years, it has 100 citations. What does that mean? That means 100 other papers or scholarly works have cited your work. And so if you go to Google Scholar and you've got one of your publications that has over 100 citations, that's a home run. That's a big hit. So I don't know how many I have. I'm going to say, I don't know, you can go to my Google Scholar page. I probably have, I don't know, 10 papers like that. I have maybe 75, 80 scientific publications. The one that's the most is my first book, 2007, The Evolutionary Basis of Consumption, probably has 500-something public citations. And you know, and then it goes from there. So imagine I post a lecture, I mean, an academic lecture. It's a lecture that I gave at Cornell. And by Elon, sharing it, 26 million views. Now, if you're in the business of spreading ideas, creating ideas and spreading them, how could you not be excited by the reality that we have today? And so I'm always amazed that so few professors are still on social media, are still using all of these incredible tools that we have. I mean, look what we're doing right now here. I don't know how many people have joined us, but, 800, 500, 1,000. So I'm giving a lecture now to 1,000 people, 2,000. And by the way, as always, I do this impromptu, which is, I keep repeating, it's the worst thing to do. You want to habituate people to a certain schedule. You want to tell them, hey, every Monday, every Wednesday at 8 o'clock, we're doing an X Spaces. This is how you grow your audience. But I'm just driven by, impulse. If I'm in the mood to connect with people, I just turn it on and I go. So in any case, Mossab Hassan Youssef grew up in Islam, hardcore Islam. I hate to use the word radical Islam because Islam is Islam. And he decided, no, this is wrong. He started working with the Israeli, services. He saved a lot of lives through his intelligence, intelligence gathering, lives of both Palestinians and Israelis, right? I mean, he doesn't differentiate. He's for humanity. He wants children, whether they're Jewish or Muslim, to grow up with dignity, to grow up with hope. And so listen to our chat. But now imagine the kind of risks this guy took when he was within that world, right? This is not you writing to me and saying, "Dear Dr. Saad, I'm currently working at such and such company. I can't stand the diversity statements. I'd really like to speak against it, but I'm afraid that I won't get the promotion that I'm looking for." Boo-hoo-hoo. F off. This guy put his life on the line. The things that they would do to him if they found out what would happen, what he was doing, the things that they could do to him now if they found out who he is, where he is, are unthinkable. So it's almost impossible to imagine that level of courage. That's a hero. That's a man of dignity. That's a man of principle. He said, it doesn't matter the background that I come from. It doesn't matter the brainwashing that I face. He went through some very, very difficult situations in his childhood. I think some of them are public, but I won't repeat them here. I know some of them, through our private conversations. And yet he came out and said, I'm speaking out against this. When you speak to him, as I did yesterday, you see, you're dealing with him. In Arabic, you say, shakhsiyye means he's a person. He's a somebody when you talk to him. He's deep. He's intense. He's got integrity. He's got courage. He's a man. Okay, that's what the West is lacking. So, no, your sister who's wearing the keffiyeh and her name is Nancy Smith and she thinks she understands the Palestinian plight, free Palestine, F off, Nancy. You know nothing. You're a degenerate. Okay, so there is Mossab Hassan Youssef. Let's go on. Omar Muhammad. Oh, my God. Oh, by the way, all of these guys, you should be going. Now that I'm mentioning their names, you should go and watch and listen to our chats. These are all people who've come on my show. Omar Muhammad is, in Arabic, his pseudonym was Ain al-Mosul. Ain in Arabic means eye. Mosul is the city of Mosul in Iraq. So Ain al-Mosul means Mosul eye, Mosul's eye. Now, why was he called that? Because when ISIS, ISIS, Daesh, the maniacs of the Islamic State, right? This is not your boss not giving you your promotion because you spoke out against Black Lives Matter. Boo-hoo-hoo, you're so scared to speak. Mosul is under complete ISIS control. Every day, they're taking people to the central square to cut off their hands and behead them, to stone the women, to... Sorry, my computer died. I'm taping this session, so excuse me a second. Yeah. So all of these horrible things are happening, and he is documenting that stuff and posting it to the world so that the world can see what ISIS is doing. And they're trying all sorts of ways to identify who he is. And he's got to use all these encrypted methods, which if they fail, he gets beheaded, as does his entire family. Oh, boo-hoo-hoo, but you're afraid to talk about BLM because your boss might not invite you to the holiday party. My God, you're so courageous. Okay. Now, again, my point is not to, well, actually, it is to shame people. I was going to say my point is not to shame people, but that would be a lie. There is no war that you can engage in where you're guaranteed free passage. As I always tell people, hey, you remember those kids that landed on the beaches of Normandy, those 18-year-olds that said, oh, please choose me. Choose me to go off the amphibian boat, land on the Normandy beaches where there are 5,000 rotary machine guns of the Nazis that are going to mow down 95% of us like little insignificant ants and mosquitoes. Yeah, sign me up. I'll do it. But you're really afraid because if you talk about BLM, you may get a bad grade from your really mean professor. My God, the courage you have, Kafiya boy. All right. So Omar Muhammad, by the way, one of the commandants, or I don't know what the title was, the military rank of ISIS, was living next door to him. And Omar, I mean, and if you meet this guy, he's not 7 foot tall. He's not built like Hercules, but guess what? His courage is 100 Hercules. His courage is it can't be measured. We don't have an instrument yet that can measure his courage. So when I sat there and talked to him, I'm sitting in front of real greatness. I see, and look, greatness comes in any faith and no faith. Musab Hassan Yusuf, born into Islam. Omar Muhammad, born into Islam, two of the most courageous, noble men of virtue and integrity that I've ever met. Let's go on. I'm not going to go through all these because it'd be too many, so I'm just going to skip to a few. I'm going to go now. I have about 20 of them here. So I think I said on Twitter that I would do 20, but if I do 20, I've got so many things to say about each one. I'll keep you here for the next 5 hours. So I'll just do a few more. Maybe I'll spend a bit less time on each. Faisal Saeed Al-Mutar was an early guest. He's now gotten his American citizenship. He's an Iraqi gentleman who, his family was back in Iraq, and he was starting to speak out against some of this nonsense. So again, you want courage? You're fleeing all that craziness. You grew up in the world of Saddam Hussein and post-Saddam Hussein. You're growing up in some of the biggest butchery. I mean, I should know, right? I was in the Lebanese Civil War. That's why listen to these people and what they warn you. Don't listen to your bullshit friends that go to Oberlin and Columbia. So Faisal Saeed Al-Mutar, he hasn't been that active recently, but early on he was doing some good things. I think he was trying to get some of the books, for example, of Christopher Hitchens and Richard Dawkins translated into Arabic so that they can be distributed to the Middle East. So he's a big guy. Asra Nomani is a incredible woman, also Muslim. Of course, Faisal is also Muslim. Asra Nomani has been on my show a few times. She's been instrumental not only in fighting some of the extremist Islamic influences in the United States, the Muslim Brotherhood types, CARE, the Council on American Islamic Relations, which is just a front for the Muslim Brotherhood. She's also been involved in some of the diversity, inclusion, equity stuff that you see happening. I think she's in Virginia, I believe. So Asra Nomani is a, while she you know, I think, I don't want to speak for her, but I think she identifies herself culturally as a Muslim. She certainly recognizes that there are some deeply, deeply problematic elements in Islam that the world should know about. Dr. Bill Warner, who's not a Muslim, one of the few on this list that I've chosen to talk about today, but who's really important. Dr. Warner is a physicist by training, but then later in his career, he decided to apply the scientific method, specifically content analysis, to study, to do a quantitative hermeneutics, if you'd like, on Islam. He founded a center called the Center for the Study of Political Islam. And so what he does, basically, he doesn't have to sit and emote about, you know, does Islam preach love or not. He just applies quantitative, rigorous content analysis. How many times does a particular text preach love? How many times does it preach hate or division? How many times are the Jews treated kindly in that book? How many times are they treated bad? So using a very tight and rigorous coding methodology, he can arrive at certain quantifiable conclusions. So I would highly recommend you go check out the Center for the Study of Political Islam by Dr. Bill Warner. Now, the reason why I say he's courageous, because as you might imagine, he puts himself in harm's way by, even though he's not someone who's fiery, he doesn't say things to frivolously offend people, he's applying the rigor of science and, you know, analytics to these very important topics. Okay, so some of you might remember that in Chapter 7 of The Parasitic Mind, I talk about nomological networks of cumulative evidence. So one of which is, if you're trying to say, hey, is a religion peaceful or not, you can build a nomological network of cumulative evidence to answer that question, one of which, one line of evidence, would be to do a formal canonical analysis of its canonical texts, right? So you could do that, by the way, for anything. You could study a literary story, a Shakespearean play, and say, how often are women's body parts extolled in this play? So you can do a formal analysis, you know, using whatever specific thing that you'd like to study. And so it's a very powerful tool to do an exegesis or, you know, a hermeneutics analysis of a religious text. So Dr. Bill Warner. Dr. Salim Mansour is a political scientist here in Canada. He was at University of Western Ontario, which subsequently became rebranded as Western Ontario. In The Parasitic Mind, I have this incredibly powerful speech that he gave to the Standing Committee on Immigration, the Canadian government, where he was warning. He is a practicing Muslim. Okay, his name is Salim Mansour. And he was railing against the immigration policy of Canada and the West in general, specifically that it makes no sense to be letting in so many people who don't share the foundational values of this culture. As you might imagine, his message did not resonate well, certainly not in academia, and certainly not amongst the greater politically correct world. Okay, let's keep going. Tommy Robinson. Not a Muslim, a blue-collar guy who's got more courage than 100 Navy SEALs. This guy has stood against a horde of angry Muslim men on the street where they're coming at him ominously, and he stands his ground. He's been sent to prison where he had to be put in solitary confinement because there were Muslim gangs in prison that were mandated to kill him. And this guy walks like he's 18 feet tall. He doesn't care. He fights. Now, you could disagree with his positions. You could agree with them. But the point of today's X Spaces is not, it's not meant to be, you know, anti-Islam or whatever. It's meant to demonstrate that, oh, you want to talk about the Middle East, you want to talk about Palestine, you want to talk about Islam, you want to talk about Israel. It's not by going to Colombia and wearing a keffiyeh and saying, hey, we're getting hungry, we're not getting enough food. I didn't know that I'd have to get hungry in order to, you know, free Palestine, keffiyeh boy. Okay? These are guys who put their lives on the line for the positions that they hold. So that's what I am extolling today, right? Let's keep going. Hazem Farraj is a guy who came on my show early on. Very handsome guy, dashing, that kind of Arabic, beautiful guy. Hazem Farraj is a Palestinian Muslim who decided to do the unthinkable, decided to do something that gets you the death penalty. And you should listen to our chat. This is from many years ago, where he says, yeah, my parents would kill me because I converted from Islam to Christianity. But I thought that Islam is the religion of peace. How come his family wants to kill him? That makes no sense. He must be mistaken. So Hazem Farraj, while he's certainly not as a public figure as some of the other people that I've mentioned, he's incredibly courageous in that he decided that despite the fact that he might be ostracized, well, he would be ostracized from his family, despite the fact that because of apostasy, because you're leaving Islam, the canonical punishment is death for apostasy. As a matter of fact, Sheikh Yusuf Qaradawi, who was the premier Sunni cleric from Al-Azhar University, the top Sunni cleric in Islam, recently passed away, said if it weren't for the apostasy laws, Islam would have died. Okay. In other words, one of the best ways you make sure that your religion grows is that you make sure that people can't leave your religion. And therefore, people stay in the religion. And one day you wake up and one-fourth of humanity is that religion. So Hazem Farraj is another one. Let me skip a few. Robert Spencer is another one. He goes by the name Jihad Watch. He's actually a very sweet, I know him personally. He's been on my show a few times. He's written many books. He's not inflammatory. He does a scholarly analysis of many of these Islamic issues. And he arrives at a conclusion based on his analysis. Now, of course, the people who hate him say, oh yeah, but he's not Muslim, but he's not Arabic, but he's not from the Middle East, but he didn't study at Al-Azhar University. Well, no. If a book is meant to be something that the whole world should abide by, then it should be available for anybody to study, correct? That's why people in Indonesia and Malaysia don't speak a word of Arabic, and yet they're Muslim, right? So that's bullshit when you say, oh, but, you know, Robert Spencer is just an American. So Robert Spencer is a guy who's had many, many death threats. But again, my point today is to say costly signaling. For taking those positions, he has to be careful. He has to walk around looking around his shoulders, which should never be the case anywhere in the world. But it certainly shouldn't be happening in the West. It certainly shouldn't be happening in the United States. But it is. Let's go on. Tariq Fatah, who recently, regrettably, passed away, has been on my show. He defined himself as a practicing Muslim, but he was a honey badger. If you saw the kind of fights he got into with Pakistanis, he would go to India and Pakistan, if I'm not mistaken. By the way, his daughter is a well-known CBC, Canadian Broadcasting Company anchor. He was fearless. I mean, he would go into a hotbed of Islamists and he would stand his ground. That's courage. He's Muslim. He's a practicing Muslim. But he realized that his religion had some problems that were incongruent with the West. And he was honest about it. All right, let's move on. Dr. David Wood is someone who's been on my show, he takes a bit more of a frontal and possibly inflammatory approach to criticizing the noble faith. He uses sarcasm. He's actually got a pretty spicy humor, which of course can upset some people, but he's had to face a lot of death threats and so on, so you can check him out. Bosh Fostin is an Albanian Muslim. You talk about, oh, Islam is the religion of the brown man. Well, there is no whiter guy than Bosh Fostin. He's basically a ghost. He's Casper. Okay, he's a ginger. He's freckled with red hair, but he's from Albania, Muslim. He left Islam. And the way he has fought his religion of birth is he's a cartoonist. And so he, in a sense, he's drawn very strong ire because, you know, you're not supposed to draw Muhammad and so on. And so he's had people who had been assigned to go and assassinate him. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, you could probably look it up on Google, they were dropped by some Texans who were there, or maybe in Arizona. I can't remember where it was. So he's faced real assassination attempts. I've actually had the chance to, I mean, he's been on my show, and I've also met him, you know, on a personal level. Lovely guy, very peaceful guy, but has the courage of 100 men, because he says, no. In the West, you can't tell people what they can draw or not draw and so on. It's not, he's not trying to go out of his way to be mean to anybody, right? But he's saying, no, I will not submit in the way you want me to submit. We don't live in Yemen here. We don't live in Pakistan. So, you know, that takes courage. By the way, you want to draw anything about Judaism, mock anything you want about Judaism, go for it. I strongly support it. You know why? Because I don't care. Whatever faith I have or no faith that I have is not dependent on the fact that you should respect it or not. Now, if you say, hey, let's go to the corner of the street where the Jews congregate and let's kill them all, well, that's not free speech. That's incitement to direct incitement to violence. But you want to say Judaism is a piece of crock? You want to say Moses is a fake prophet? Go for it. Who cares? I'm strong enough in my identity that I'm not going to break apart. So imagine if Islam had that kind of security, right? I don't care what you say about Islam. This is my religion. It brings me solace. You don't like it? So be it. Let's have hummus now. Let's get together and have fun. That's the proper way to practice your religion, certainly in the West. But that's not what's happening in the West. Anyway, so Bosch Fosten is another fantastic guy. Let's go on. All right, I finished this list. Let me go to this list. Now, this one is going to surprise you because he's now on my bad list. The Malibu Meditator. Yeah, I said it. The Malibu Meditator, Sam Harris. I first really got into Sam when he was, I mean, yes, he was an atheist, a caustic atheist who was against all religion. But then if you remember, he started specifically criticizing Islam. Again, I'm not talking about whether I like that he criticizes Islam or not. What I'm saying is he knew that he'd get a lot of flack for it, but it took courage for him to take that position. All I'm arguing about today is having the courage to stand for your convictions. Okay. Douglas Murray is another one. Of course, you know him. He's written several books about the death of the West and so on. He's also been on, everybody that I'm mentioning here has been on my show. And not, this next one is very mysterious guy. Ibn Warraq. Warraq in Arabic is paper. So the son of paper. Like, you know, it's a pseudonym that has occurred throughout in Islamic history. So Ibn Warraq, I mean, in my Arabic, we wouldn't say the k at the end. We'd say Warraq, but it's just a different pronunciation. So Ibn Warraq is an amazing guy who really knows Islam, who comes from an Islamic background, who's taken a lot of flack. He's had to be somewhat, you know, right under a pseudonym. This is not his real name because of the difficulties that he's had to face. Another guy, Brother Rashid, such an affable guy, lovely guy, comes from a North African Islamic background, converted to Christianity. That's not a good thing in that region. You do not apostatize. And he's now a strong man of faith, but of Christian faith. Again, my point is not to say, oh, bravo, you left Islam. It's to say he grew up in a very difficult environment where to make the faith-based decision that he did will bring you death, and yet he did it. So again, your son who's wearing the tight pants with the keffiyeh and going free Palestine at Columbia University is not exactly the model of heroism, okay? And who's then whining, but why aren't we getting through Uber Eats our sushi? I'm getting hungry. Okay? No, Brother Rashid apostatizing out of Islam when he's going to get a death threat. There is your courage, right? By the way, I mentioned these guys just because these are many of the people who've come on my show. But just so you don't think, oh, boo-hoo-hoo, I'm focusing on Islamic people. Imagine an ultra-Orthodox Jewish kid who grew up in a Lubavitch home. So like an ultra-Orthodox home. But yet decides one day, I'm gay. I can't live a lie. I can't get married and have 18 children and live this life. Now he knows, now the good news here is that at least the Lubavitch are not going to kill you, but he knows that if he takes the decision to leave his fold, never mind that he's gay, he just decides, I don't want to be any more ultra-Orthodox. I want to wear secular clothes. I don't want to pray 50,000 hours a day. Before I go to the bathroom, pray. Before I sit down, pray. Before I have a meal, pray. Before I go to sleep, pray. My God, God seems to really need a lot of prayers from me. All day I have to pray to him. So he decides, I don't want to pray anymore. I'm gay. Well, what happens then? He's gone. He loses his family. He's finished. Now, it doesn't happen often, but it does happen. That person is engaging in caustic signaling because he's saying, I'm willing to lose everything I've got, every marker that defines my belongingness because I have to live an authentic life. So my point about courage is not only for people who speak out, of course, against Islam or leave Islam. I'm just using those examples because we're talking about currently these protesters on campuses that are talking about issues in the Middle East that they know nothing about. That's why I'm focusing on that. But courage is not restricted to one faith, to one group, to it. You know, any group can have unbelievably courageous people or, regrettably, like most groups, a bunch of cowards. Cynthia Farahat, she's been on my show twice. Cynthia is a Coptic Christian. By the way, her husband, Jeff Higgins, was a special agent with the DEA, and he was instrumental. He's been also on my show. He's been instrumental in bringing down, at the time, the top heroin kingpin in the world that was tied to the Taliban. Incredible story. Unbelievable. Like, they should make a movie out of his life. Anyway, Cynthia Farahat is a Coptic Christian. As you know, Copts in Egypt are now about 10%. Once upon a time, they were all of Egypt. And then through mysterious, peaceful forces, they're now almost extinguished. Inshallah, in another 50-100 years, there will no longer be Copts. In any case, so she takes a lot of flack for some of the positions that she takes. That's courage. Okay? Again, I'm not trying to imply that only those who speak out against Islam are courageous. There are many, many contexts. As I said earlier, you speak out against ultra-Orthodox family values and you decide that you're gay, that takes a lot of courage. You're a fundamentalist Christian and you decide, you know what, I don't believe in God, I'm an atheist, I'm leaving. Well, again, it may be that you don't get beheaded, but it takes courage because think about those sects from the Mormon sects where the guy, the prophet of the sects, was convicted of sex crimes. Well, people are terrified to leave the fold because they were born into that in some little town in Utah or Arizona. They've known nothing else. They're told never to interact with anybody else. You know how scary it is for them to say, I'm leaving this hellhole? That takes courage, unlike your keffiyeh-wearing sister at Oberlin College. All right, let's move on. Yasmin Muhammad, I just went on her show and she agreed. She was excited that I offered her that I can also post our recent chat. Just held it last week. We talked about, you know, my background in Lebanon and so on. Yasmin Muhammad was married off to an ultra-extremist that was abusing her, and that she's Egyptian, of Egyptian background, and who had her in a niqab here in Canada. And it took unbelievable courage for her to break from her family's hold, to leave this guy who was really, really, really hardcore. I mean, this guy was no nonsense. So Yasmin Muhammad, if you see her today, she's a beautiful, kind, lovely, peaceful woman who really had the courage to break out of a very, very difficult situation. Here's another one. You ready? Imam Muhammad Tawhidi. Imam Muhammad Tawhidi, is an imam. He's become a very good personal friend. By the way, this shows you here, the imam and I have more things in common that I might actually have with an ultra-Orthodox Jewish guy. So the way that I decide who is an ally, ideological ally, comes on the basis of their individual expressions of their ideology. So here is an imam who, because of the positions that he's taken, I don't say, oh, he's Muslim, he's my enemy. No, I don't. I mean, as a matter of fact, he's a brother to me. He's lovely. We've met many times in Montreal. He's been on my show a few times. We've had incredible conversations. Now, in some cases, it might be difficult to see how he reconciles some of his own, you know, theological positions as an imam with some of my understanding of his religion. But that notwithstanding, he's had a lot of death threats. It's not easy for him to take the position that he takes. In his case, one of the ways that he does his criticism of Islam, he basically says, you know, the Quran is, you know, the book that you should go by, and he doesn't buy the Hadith. For those of you who don't know, there are really three core books in Islam. I mean, other than Sharia law, which is the reliance of the traveler. So anyways, that's a separate issue. Sharia means like the path. Sharia, okay? But in terms of the canonical books, you've got the Quran, then you've got the Hadith, and then you've got the Sirah, the biography of Muhammad. And so Imam Tawhidi basically says, well, you know, you'll see less bad stuff in the Quran than you will in the Hadith. And so using whatever, you know, canonical gymnastics that he feels comfortable with, he's able to arrive at certain conclusions that are certainly a lot more congruent with many of the values that I would hold dear. And the values that I hold dear, not as a Jewish person, but as a lover of Western liberties. Okay, let's go on. I'll do a few more and I think we'll wrap it up. Let's go with Ansaf Haidar, who's been on my show. Ansaf is the wife of Raif Badawi. Raif Badawi has already won the Sakharov Prize. Sakharov after the name of the Soviet dissident. And everybody is saying that if he were to ever be allowed to leave Saudi Arabia, he would be a guaranteed Nobel Prize winner. Who is Raif Badawi? He is a blogger who wrote an article that was construed by the Saudi government as insulting, you know, to the kingdom, to the royal family, to Islam, whatever. And believe me, he's a very gentle guy. He's not saying crazy, inflammatory stuff. He's not trying to rattle anybody's cage. But in the context of Saudi Arabia, that was perceived as too much. He was sentenced to 10 years in prison and to endless number of lashings. This is happening in the 21st century. It's been over, so he served his 10 years. They didn't implement all the lashings because his health suffered. He ended up being spared all of the sentenced lashes. But after he served his 10-year sentence, he then is still not allowed to leave Saudi Arabia. His wife, Ansaf, immigrated with her three gorgeous children to Quebec. They live here in Quebec, about 2 hours away from where I am. I've had the privilege and pleasure of meeting them all. I've seen them grow up. They're absolutely lovely family. I mean, there is the immigrants that you want. They come here. They want to contribute. They don't want to do any of the crazy stuff. They don't want to change the society to be similar to the one that they left. Now, the reason why I'm mentioning it is because for the courage of speaking his mind, Raif has paid, in my view, maybe a penalty that's even greater than death. He knows that the passage of time is causing his children to grow up, and yet he's not there to see them grow up. they're thousands of miles away, and he's in a prison, even if he might be let out of prison now, that doesn't allow him to see his children grow. What could be more cruel? And so, again, that's what courage is. Nur bin Laden has come on my show. She is the niece of Osama bin Laden, the niece of Osama bin Laden. And yet she, of course, speaks in less than complimentary ways about her uncle. That takes courage. Ayan Hirsi Ali. Ayan Hirsi Ali, as some of you know, is a Somali woman who left an arranged marriage. She had had female genital mutilation done on her, given her Islamic background in Somalia. And yes, it's not only Islam that does these female genital mutilations, but it's certainly quite extensive within that region. And she escaped, moved to the Netherlands, learned Dutch, got an education, became a parliamentarian in the Dutch parliament. And then eventually, because of the number of death threats on her, one of her friends, filmmaker, was assassinated. A Dutch filmmaker, assassinated by a noble person of peace. And then she moved to the United States. She was at one point at Harvard. The risks to her safety were too great. And now she moved elsewhere. I've gotten to know her. I'd like to say that I consider her a friend, as I do her husband, the famous, esteemed historian Neil Ferguson. Very, very courageous, because again, at great personal cost, she took the risks to speak her mind. So that's Ayan Hirsi Ali. Let me see if I've got any other ones that I'm missing on this list. I'll mention, I think, three more and I'll wrap it up, which will take us to almost an hour. I think I've probably mentioned about 20. Masih Ali Nijad. Masih in Arabic, Masihi or Masih is like the Christian or the prophet of Christianity, right? If you say Muslim, it's one who is Muslim, right? If you say Yahudi, it's someone who is Jewish. If you say Masihi, it's Christian, Christ, okay? So Masih Ali Nijad is a Iranian woman who, this here, she's not necessarily speaking out against Islam. She is certainly speaking out against the theocracy of the Iranian Islamic regime, and speaking about the emancipation of women within Islamic societies. She does that at great personal risk. She does that with a lot of passion. You want to talk about courage? How about the courage, while it's sad to say, how about the courage of the Iranian women who are willing to go out into the street without their hijabs on? Oh, but I thought the hijab was just a choice. Well, apparently not. And if the moral police finds you without you wearing the hijab, then you disappear into some hellhole where you are gang raped and then you're found dead. And yet they do it. Now, how do these Iranian women compare on courage to your kafiya friend at Oberlin College and Columbia? Free, free Palestine. That doesn't take much courage, because you didn't get your Uber Eats sushi. You degenerate, pampered, entitled prick. Now what? Am I saying that people don't have a right to politically protest? Of course not. Free country, freedom of speech, First Amendment. But you have a right to start putting roadblocks? Are you Jewish? Are you Zionist? And if so, you're not allowed entry on campus? Where are we? That's insane. All right. So Masih Ali Nijad, Iranian activist. Let's move on to someone who is not from that region, but is as courageous, has one of the worst personal stories ever. Yeonmi Park, escaped from North Korea. You want to talk about barbarian? Maybe this is a place that competes and takes the championship of barbarism, worse than probably any place in the Middle East. It certainly puts up a good competition. It's a closed, repressive hellhole. You don't You don't cry enough when dear leader dies. Off you go with your entire family and the next three generations to the slave camps. She escaped with her mother. She's been on my show. She's written a couple of best-selling books. She's unbelievable. She's incredible. I won't give you all the details of what she went through, but the type of courage that is required to go through the craziness that she went through in the hope of escaping to come to the free West, that's courage. Your keffiyeh-wearing friend who is for Queers for Palestine is not courageous. It's a parasitized person. It's a person that doesn't know that in Gaza, the psychiatrists there have a 100% successful conversion therapy. It's a gravity-based conversion therapy. That's what the morons, Queers for Palestines, are supporting. You're queer and you're supporting Gaza? All right. And then finally, the last gentleman I'm going to mention for today is Luai Ahmed, who is a Yemeni man, a gay man, who left Yemen because of this little thing called death sentence for gays. But wait a minute. I thought that Islam was completely tolerant of everybody. Apparently not, because in Yemen, they will put you to death. And by the way, you can go and look at which are the countries that still have the death penalty when it comes to homosexuality. And it's not only Islamic countries, but it is largely Islamic countries. And it's not only Islamic countries that are homophobic, of course not. But 21st century death penalty, yes, there is a recurring theme. Well, Mr. Ahmed left Yemen, moved to Sweden, started seeing the insanity that was happening in Sweden because of the immigration policies there, and started putting out these videos that have gone viral. I noticed him at one point, invited him on my show. We had an incredible chat. And that takes a lot of courage, because I believe that his mother and some of his family are still back in Yemen. So it takes a lot of courage for you to be coming out and speaking out against some of these issues. So to conclude, folks, virtue signaling is exactly that. It's virtue signaling because it is costless, because it doesn't take, there's no skin in the game. There's no skin off your back to engage in this performative bullshit. Now, by the way, today I focused specifically on, you know, the Palestinian protest, the Hamas protest, the Israel-Palestine dynamic, Islam, Middle East, only because I wanted to contextualize what virtue signaling is in the context of the pro-Hamas and pro-Palestine campus protest versus actual costly signaling from that region. But we could apply that principle for all sorts of other types of behaviors, right? But again, the framework that you have to remember is one of, does the behavior impose an honest, handicapping, costly signal? The people that I have listed for you today have incurred that cost. They've incurred all of the most costly repercussions that one can incur because of their courage and bravery. So there you have it, folks. Don't be impressed by those bullshitters on campuses. Hopefully this will die down. Hopefully we can return to sanity where people can disagree peacefully, where people can engage in rational debates. May the best ideas win. But this kind of true non-protected agitation is intolerable. You can't be telling people, oh, are you a Zionist? Or are you Jewish? Are you wearing Star of David? You're not welcome in the zone. This is liberated, occupied territory. This can't be tolerated in the West. Because if you tolerate that, you'll be waking up tomorrow having a repeat of the civil war that I escaped from in the 70s. There you have it, folks. I think most of you who follow me know this, but let me mention it. I hold zero ill will to any human being who is honest, peaceful, dignified, who holds values of individual freedom. You want to practice your religion in the privacy of your thoughts, of your mind, of your home, without imposing any costs onto others. Go for it. But the second that you impose 1 millimeter of your ideas onto me, then we're no longer friends. And so whenever I speak out against any ideology that seeks to reduce our ethos of liberty. Guys, please consider subscribing. It's now 10:06. Please consider purchasing copies of my books. Again, it's not because, you know, the Jew is trying to make money. It's because I'm in the business of spreading ideas. One of the ways that I spread ideas is by doing these sessions, which are now all done for free at 10 o'clock at night. One of the ways you can repay me is you subscribe to my stuff. You share my stuff. You subscribe to my channel, which is for free. You buy copies of my book. My latest book, The Sad Truth About Happiness, the paperback edition, is coming out on May 14th. If enough of you buy it, it could enter the bestseller list. Why is that important? Because then more people buy it. And believe me, we need some happiness in today's world. It's a great optimistic book. It's a positive book. It's got nothing to do with all the stuff that we've been talking about today. It's a combination of my own personal trajectory of happiness backed up by ancient wisdoms and contemporary science. It's a great read. But frankly, it hasn't found the audience that some of my earlier books have, for all sorts of reasons, some of which are beyond my control. For example, my publisher was bought out just as my book was coming out. And so, you know, you fall through the cracks. So, but now I have a second chance because it's coming out now on paperback. It's being re-released. I have a chance for, you know, having another book launch. May 14th, it happens. Go out. You can buy a copy. It's probably less than $15 if you pre-order it. And I wish you all a fantastic day. I hope that you enjoyed this session. I will be posting it also on my YouTube channel and podcast. Thank you so much for your support, and I'll talk to you soon. Cheers, everybody.